This is Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Jacob McClelland. On today's program, we'll listen to a panel discussion from the Oklahoma Policy Institute's State Budget Summit, recorded on January the 28th in Oklahoma City. The discussion was edited for time. The panel includes State Auditor Gary Jones, Republican Senator Clark Jolly, Mickey Heppner from the UCO School of Business, Secretary Chuck Hoskin Jr. of the Cherokee Nation, Democratic Representative Scott Inman, and Norman Mayor Cindy Rosenthal. DeMario Solomon Simmons served as the moderator. They began by talking about whether plummeting oil and natural gas prices are the only thing to blame for the current fiscal crisis, starting with Auditor Gary Jones.
Let me say this. The quarter-cent tax cut that was implemented recently didn't cause the problem we're in. And the cutting the severance tax from 7% to 2% didn't cause it. The real cause is because of the downfall in the oil prices, and it created a hole. But I will tell you, the 7% cut to 2% and the 0.25% dug that hole a lot deeper. And because of that, what we have been experiencing is that I'm a CPA, I'm an accountant. I understand the fact that when you look at a balance sheet, as the governor mentioned, that both sides of the balance sheet have to balance. And when you look at cutting revenues, unless you are able to cut expenses equally, then you have to resort to going into reserves. And so what we've been doing is spending down our reserves. And I said this several times, that we are at the point where we're not willing to afford all the government we have, meaning that the revenues necessary to run the government we have don't sustain it. So that being said, we've got to set priorities. And I will tell you that, you know, cutting things across the board equally is not setting priorities. And there's some things that we're going to have to do away with. There's some things we're going to have to do efficiently. And everybody's going to have to sacrifice. And that's the situation we're in.
I think what Auditor Jones said is, in many ways, is exactly right. There's not one cause for this. It's a combination of multiple factors, and it's going to take multiple solutions to get us out of here. We are not going to solve this problem by raising taxes. We are not going to solve this problem by doing budget cuts. We are not going to solve this problem by a one cut or one type of solution. It's going to have to be a multifaceted approach to get us out of this, because it was a multifaceted approach that got us here. I think you also have to look at apportionments off the top. When you look, and David referenced it in his talk, when I arrived at the legislature in 2004, the amount of money that we were expending in transportation was the same amount basically that we were expending in 1984, not even adjusted for inflation. And we saw the result of that with having incredible numbers of deficient roads and bridges in our state. And so we passed the roads program. And I think without question, passing the roads program has been very, very beneficial to improve the quality of our roads and bridges in Oklahoma. In fact, we see that by the end of this decade, we will have eliminated all of the structurally deficient bridges that were on the list at the beginning. That is remarkable progress. That's also $470 million that is off the top before anyone at the legislature gets to spend it. That's $470 million off the top. It's gone. It's history. We aren't going to be able to appropriate it. And when we talk about the budget, it really is not $7.1, $7.2 billion. The budget for the state of Oklahoma is closer to $24, $25 billion, because the Department of Transportation's budget is not $180 million. The State Department of Transportation's budget is that $180 million plus the $470 million that is off the top apportionment that they get without an appropriation from the legislature. Then they also have their federal funds that they receive as well. And so when you look at the total combined budget, we really see that government spending has never been higher in Oklahoma than it is currently. The difference is that the appropriated budget has been flat for the past several years, and I don't care if it's education or healthcare or whatever segment you want to talk about, we've seen an increase in population that is demanding service. We've seen an increase in aged population for our Medicaid. We've seen an increase in our student population for education. And having a flat budget is having difficulty to keep up with that. So I think it's numerous factors, not just one, that have gotten us to where we are today.
You don't have to go in order. You can, but you don't have to. Go ahead.
Yeah, we're just going that way. I would agree. It's been a number of different things. Of course, the decline in energy prices are really making an incredible impact. And those are driven by a couple of different factors. You have technological advances, increasing supply, geopolitical forces, increasing the amount of oil coming onto the world market. And you even have some economic crises in Europe and in China that increase the value of the dollar, that decrease the price of oil and energy in general. All those things coming together at once to really continually pushing energy prices down. And I have to say, the full impact of that decline has not been felt yet. Right, so the full impact on the state budget, the full impact on the labor market, the full impact on the state economy is still to come. The next 18 to 24 months are going to be much tougher than what we've seen so far, and that's kind of alarming to me. But the other biggest thing, if we focus just on what's happened recently, if we focus just on what's happening right now, we miss the bigger picture. We miss the picture that for a decade we've neglected that this crisis was coming. We could have seen for a decade that energy prices would someday fall, and they have a couple of times now in this decade. We could have seen for a decade that we weren't setting aside enough money to handle this eventual decline that we knew would come. We could have seen for a decade that we were enacting permanent tax cuts when we had temporary surpluses. We could have seen all of this, but we didn't. And now we're stuck in a place where the train wreck is coming. All the levers we could use to stop it aren't available to us. And so the crash in terms of the state budget is coming in the next few months. So again, a number of forces, many of which were beyond our control, but if we look back honestly over the last decade, we'll see that there were many that we could have foreseen and could have acted on.
Well, in terms of responsibility, you know, we share a collective responsibility for the mess that we are in, and it is a mess. We, as a state, collectively were content to send leadership to Oklahoma City that peddled the fiction that somehow if we cut taxes low enough, we would spur growth. That's a fiction. The fact of the matter. The fact is, investing in education is a good investment. The return on the investment in higher education, several dollars you put into a university system, you get more out the other end. Public education, you put in dollars in the front end, you get more in the out the other side. So, and Mr. Jones is correct when he talks about being able to pay for the government we want. What government do we want? I can tell you there's a little school in one of the poorest parts of the Cherokee Nation, Adair County, Cave Spring Schools, that saw a 28% cut in its state appropriations from 2008 during the recession to the present time. Now, those kids didn't deserve 28% less education. Those kids deserve more, and they got less, and we balanced the budget on their backs. Now, there are a lot of structural reasons we're in the mess we're in fiscally, and the oil and gas taxes are part of it. But do we need to tie our fate to that kind of volatility? And while we're tying our fate to that kind of volatility, do we need to go ahead and cut income taxes? We don't need to do it. We need to go the opposite direction. But it's our collective responsibility, and it depends on who we send to Oklahoma City.
Good morning. It's really an honor and a pleasure to be here. I love Oklahoma Policy Institute, and I love being able to come and visit with you all today. I will say this, DeMario is right. He and I are very good friends. We've known each other for a long time. But DeMario, I will warn you that if you ask me any questions that I feel are inappropriate or overly hostile, I will never debate on your television network. It's a true story. Just not going to do it. If it works on the national level, I can do it here, right? But how did we get here? I guess the question was is why are we where we are right now? And I think the question really needs to be posed: why were we where we were 4 years ago? What I mean by that is this: it's easy to go and look at the price of oil being less than $30 a barrel and say, well, yeah, that's the principal driver in the budget cuts that are coming this particular cycle. But what those in charge, the governor and the pro tem and the speaker, have yet to answer for is well, when the price of oil was $100 a barrel, why did you cut most state agencies by 25%? Why did you cut the school funding formula by 24%, deeper than any other state in the nation? You see, those are the answers that really need to be flushed out, because until we understand that, until we understand those answers, we're going to continue to repeat the situation that we're in today. The reason we are where we are is because, as David said before, over the last decade, we've cut $1 billion worth of income taxes. We've seen an explosion in in tax credits and exemptions. In the legislature's infinite wisdom, they decided that the wealthiest industry in the entire world, which does great things in Oklahoma in terms of creating jobs, I'm not here knocking the oil and gas industry per se, but they decided to give them the lowest gross production tax in the country. I mean, it's other 1% or free. I mean, that's basically what it was, right? And so you put all of that together, and then you look at other states around us. When Texas has a 7% gross production tax at the state level, they've got county-wide gross production taxes they could levy. You look at the state of North Dakota that had an 11% gross production tax, and you look at what they did. While we were cutting education budgets and healthcare budgets and have the 7,000 folks on the DDSD waiting list and have nursing home reimbursement rate cuts and 1 in 5 of our citizens without any health insurance, while we were doing that, North Dakota and Texas and others were growing their not only improving funding for their education and all those other programs, but they were also storing money away for this eventuality. We didn't do that. The fiscal decisions that were made over the last decade have put us in this situation, and we are here where we are, basically by what the Secretary said. We're here because we've got a group of elected officials who would rather govern by political philosophy than by political reality. It is only due to a blind adherence to a political philosophy that would allow every member of the Republican majority in the House of Representatives to defeat my amendment that I put on the floor last session that would have stopped an income tax cut from taking effect in January. We had a $600 million shortfall then. We were looking down the barrel of a billion-plus shortfall coming up this next session, and I offered up an amendment. And normally, just to show you the hubris that exists in the legislature, normally when any member of my caucus offers up an amendment on the House floor, it is summarily dismissed with, Representative Inman, would you like to explain your amendment? I explain it. Somebody stands up and says, we move to table. It's not even an up or down vote on the amendment. It's tabled, and we're on to the rest of the whatever bill is at hand. But in this instance, in the midst of a $600 million shortfall, looking at a billion-dollar shortfall, something happened that's never happened to me in 9 years in the legislature. It was the Speaker's bill. I was amending his bill to just stop this income tax cut in January. And you know what the caucus did? They got together and they decided that they were so right that they didn't want to table my amendment. They wanted to debate it. They wanted to flog me openly on the House floor. At least that's what they thought they were going to do. They wanted to ask me lots of questions, and they wanted an up or down vote because they believed that their trickle-down economic tax cut plan was actually good for the state. And so we debated it for over an hour. They asked me questions for over an hour. And when it was all said and done, every single one of them, conservative, moderate, liberal, if there are such things in the House Republican caucus, every one of them voted against that amendment that would have stopped what happened now. And so what we have to do is say, we cut by 25% in most state agencies 4 years ago when it was $100 a barrel. We cut income taxes today. We did all of these decisions because we're adhering to a failed political philosophy. And until our leaders throw that by the wayside and start governing by political reality, we're going to continue to make these same mistakes.
Thank you, Scott. With the mayor's permission, I just want to go to Senator Jolly real quickly, give him an opportunity to respond to that. We bringing up Republicans or Auditor Jones.
I would just say
briefly,
that,
though, please.
I would just say that the largest tax cut that I recall ever us passing was authored by Democrat Senator J. Paul Gumm and signed into law by Brad Henry. So I think both parties, from my recollection, were touting tax cuts. Both parties were supportive of them throughout the years. We had members of both parties that voted against them. We had some people that in my party said, no, this is not good policy because we're doing it during high oil and gas prices, and those are going to fall. But the largest tax cut that I ever remember us voting on, Secretary Hoskin may be right, maybe who we're sitting up there, because it's both parties that have gotten us to where we are. If you think the Republican Party is the only one that has said, hey, we're in favor of tax cuts, go look at the author of the tax cuts that we've had to take us from 7 down to 5, and I think you'll see that there are plenty of people on both sides of the aisle that have been the authors. It's not just the Republican Party that has done tax cuts. So with my good friend from Del City that we both attended the same public high school from Del City, Oklahoma, I would just let him know that it's both parties that have acted this way, not just one.
Okay. Our Mayor Rosenthal.
I want to take a little bit of credit here because Secretary Hoskins and Representative Inman both passed my state government class with flying colors back in the 90s. Ch- I have to say, though, also to Senator Jolly, I have a number of graduates that I had as undergraduates who were on the Republican side of the aisle as well. The question was, who's to blame? And I think Secretary Hoskins made a very important point that there's a collective responsibility here. But I want to add a postscript to say it's not local government that got us into this problem. And yet we are also suffering the consequences of the decisions that have been made on Lincoln Avenue at the state capitol. You know, it's remarkable to me as someone who moved here in the early 80s that we have not transformed our fundamental state economy since the 80s, and we are suffering from the same problems that we had back then. And until and unless we are committed to building a 21st century economy in this state, we're going to continue to suffer from these consequences. The one point that I want to emphasize is that I know that David talked today about raising revenues and increasing revenues. We have to really look very seriously at broadening the base. It is the issue of the fact that we're giving away $7 billion at the state level in incentives and credits. And to the extent that some of those are on sales tax, the sole source of revenue for local government, the sole source of revenue for cities and towns in the state of Oklahoma. And we are the only state for which that is the method of funding local government. It is a sales tax, for better or for worse. But for every dollar that's taken out of the state coffers from sales tax, there's another dollar coming out of local government. And that's impacting significantly our ability to create towns and communities, to invest in infrastructure. And it's my plea also to the legislature that they look at ways to allow local governments to act and broaden their own base, whether that's allowing school districts by a vote of the people to go above the ad valorem tax cap, or local government to look at other sources of revenue such as ad valorem to do operations. We've got to give local government the tools, and that's you'll hear that from me again probably as we go through this panel.
I want to address the situation. I serve on the Board of Equalization, and David mentioned that Senator Mazie has a bill to challenge the decision the Board of Equalization made. In December of 2014, what we were put forward before the Board of Equalization was the bill that was passed, that was law, that said that it is the Board of Equalization's responsibility to compare an estimate that was made in February of 2016, which was the official estimate to do the 2014 budget, to the December estimate, which is not even the official estimate. So we're comparing an estimate that's not official to an estimate that we already know the actual number. And the law says that if the second number is higher than the first number, then we have to vote to trigger the tax cut. I asked our attorney from the Attorney General's office, I said, I don't like this. Can I vote no? He said, no. Your only decision is whether or not this number is bigger than that number. I will tell you, if I had a decision as whether or not I thought it was a good idea, I would have voted no. And I stand behind Senator Mazie. We need to overturn it.
So taxes have been mentioned several times. Increasing, decreasing. And I think everyone agrees on the panel that there's a plethora of reasons why we're in this particular situation, and not one thing will actually get us out of the situation. But the question I would pose to everyone, should increasing taxes be one of the things that we should look at to help us out of this budget crisis?
I think the political reality is State Question 640, and a few of us were talking about that right before we began this. State Question 640 pretty much makes it the dead last option that the legislature can consider, because you have to get 76 people in the House of Representatives to vote yes. And you got to get 36 people in the state Senate to vote yes. And if you don't do that, then you don't get to count it for this budget year. You have to send it to a vote of the people. And so for the political reality of it is that the legislature has been completely hamstrung
So much so that I think most of us are familiar with Grover Norquist and his little pledge that he wants people to sign. Pro Tem Stratton Taylor was a signer of the I Will Not Raise Taxes pledge because he knew we would never raise taxes in the Oklahoma State Legislature because we're prevented basically from doing it. We can pass it to the voters, but if we pass it to the voters, we don't get to count it for this current budget year. I mean, there's polling that shows the cigarette tax from a policy standpoint that people favor raising the cigarette tax like 2-1. Even Republican primary voters are supportive of raising the cigarette tax like 60%. I don't know that we could get the cigarette tax passed through the State House of Representatives and the State Senate. Even with polling numbers that say, please tax us on our cigarettes, I don't know that we could get it done because we have such that high a threshold. So I think the reality of it is that we're gonna have to look at other options that are more politically possible first. But I don't know that with the size of the budget shortfall that we have, we're going to be able to get there without somebody at the end of the day saying, hey, we've got to look at whether or not we need to generate more revenue. I think that's something we're going to have to consider at the end if we can't get there through the other means. And it is going to be a huge challenge to get there through budget cuts, apportionment reforms, tax credit reforms. It will be a huge task to get there, and having those handcuffs on us just really kills us.
DeMario, I would suggest that if you talk to a lot of the members with whom I work in the majority caucus in the House, and you talk to our friends over at the OCPA, they would argue that there's no need to, right? That's the whole purpose of the cutting taxes, was to watch it trickle down and come back up, right? That was the theory. So their whole position is going to be, no, we don't need to increase taxes. We'll just wait it out. Wait for it all to come back. That's going back to that failed political philosophy versus political reality, right? This is an opportunity for us as leaders, not just in elected office, but the leaders in the business community and the nonprofit community, those of you who are here, to really educate those folks in power. The idea that you can continue to cut taxes and somehow it's going to grow back has been tried and tried and tried since Art Laffer and Ronald Reagan, and it just hasn't worked, right? It hasn't. And so here's an opportunity for us to go in and say, well, we need to reverse course. Our problem is this, and Senator Jolly's right. You want to talk about raising $150 million on the cigarette tax? While personally and my members of my caucus, several of whom are here, we may not have a philosophical opposition to that if it reduces smoking and has better health outcomes, yada, yada, yada. We get that. But the fact of the matter is whether you're talking about the Boren tax plan or whether you're talking about the cigarette tax increase, what's happening is those in charge realize, they won't say it, but they realize they screwed up. They cut taxes too deeply, and it's going to take revenues, as the treasurer says. We have a revenue problem, not a spending problem. It's going to take new revenues. Now, they won't do what they really should do is roll back the tax cuts that help cause this problem. So what they'll do is they'll go out and raise taxes on my 85-year-old grandmother. She doesn't smoke, but if you raise sales taxes, it costs her to get more. It costs her more money at Brahms to get a gallon of milk when that income tax cut that came down with her Social Security check and a little bit that she makes from my grandfather's retirement, she felt no benefit from that. But we're going to offset the tax cuts that folks that don't necessarily live in Del City didn't. We're going to offset the tax cuts that we didn't receive by making us pay for it. And so from our perspective, if you want to put together a broad-based tax structure, as Dr. Rosenthal said, we're for it. If the legislature, if the governor came to us tomorrow and said, hey, let's have a conversation. Let's look at tweaking the income tax again. We'll look at the sales tax base. We'll look at the cigarette tax. It'll be an overall tax reform package that would affect folks in all different income brackets in all different parts of the state. My caucus would say, this is a legitimate conversation. Let's discuss it. But I'll be honest with you right now. If they come at me and say, let's raise taxes on the poor to make up for the tax cuts we passed for the rich, my caucus is going to say no.
Mayor.
Again, I think broadening the base is critical, and I think a comprehensive approach to tax reform is what is needed. The work that the late Representative Dank did looking at tax credits needs to be carried forward. I think providing for a sunset of all tax credits and then justifying the reinstitution of those tax credits on the basis of real performance and real economic need is another way of moving forward in this area. I just think it's not easy, it's not my job, and I don't envy our two state legislators who are here, but it has to be done. And so a comprehensive reform package, I think, is the best way to go. Personally, and I think you'll see lower rates, frankly, if you broaden the base, not higher rates.
Auditor Jones, you had your hand?
Yeah, thank you. I think we have to have everything on the table. You know, there are areas in government that we can cut. There are areas in government that we need to spend more. We need to really take a good look at that. If we truly have priorities, we need to focus on those priorities, but we also need to really look at where our tax structure is and look at reforming the tax system, like the mayor said. The tax credits, we've been talking about that for 5 years. I was on the task force with Representative Dank, and he did yeoman's work. That's been 5 years since we've been working on that, and now we're talking about finally meeting and doing something. I would propose that we suspend all tax credits till they're reviewed, and then we can determine whether or not. And if you do that, then you'll put some urgency in the process, as opposed to dragging this out for another 5 or 10 years.
Dean Hebner, you're the only non-elected official on the panel. From just a purely economic standpoint, what would you say about having on the table comprehensive tax reform?
Setting aside the politics of it and focusing just on the economics, which is where I get to spend my life, not where you guys are. To me, it's pretty clear. We have a situation where in Oklahoma, we are a relatively low tax state. We're also a relatively incredibly low spending state when it comes to government spending. And specifically, we're a relatively low income tax state. So that's an opportunity for us if we need additional revenue, which I think we will, because we're looking at least 1.1, I'm guessing probably a little bit more, $1.3 billion shortfall this coming year, plus another one for the year after that, using the income tax to generate some additional revenue, rolling back the tax cuts makes perfect sense, right? The thing is, though, we have to keep in mind that Representative Emmons was correct. We're a relatively low income tax state, but we're a relatively high sales tax state. And so when we resort to raising sales taxes, we create other distortions and other problems that frankly spill over to impact municipalities. One of the things that the Oklahoma Academy, a nonpartisan group of business, government, and education leaders in the state, has been recommending for several years now is giving municipalities the freedom and the flexibility to move away from using sales taxes only to operate their cities, their government. And the problem is that they have to rely so heavily on those sales taxes to do so. Our sales taxes at the state and local level are really high. And if we want to close this gap by raising sales taxes even more, that makes that problem even worse, and it further constrains the ability of the cities to serve to solve their problems. We have incredibly low property taxes, right? Incredibly low property taxes in the state. And so if we're not going to raise income taxes, and we shouldn't raise sales taxes, there's one other viable option from an economic perspective, setting aside the politics, right?
I'm going to scoot away from you here in a minute.
Yeah.
A politician to set aside the politics?
I'll set aside the politics. But to me, that's the other option. So if we want to eliminate the income tax, as an economist, I can see incredible value to doing that or further reducing it. You have to make up that revenue somewhere else. If we really want to be like Texas and eliminate that income tax or reduce it even further, we need to be like Texas and increase that property tax. If we're not willing to do that, if we're not willing to take that step, then we should stop eliminating the income tax and rely more on that for our revenue. So from an economic perspective, it's pretty clear. We're not bringing in the revenue we need to have to fund the government that we need to have. So we solve that by trying to bring in a little bit more revenue. So yeah, it should be on the table.
Secretary Hoskin, can you explain how the budget crisis is impacting the Cherokee Nation and Native Nations in particular, and how you guys are trying to help the state of Oklahoma get out of this particular problem?
Sure, and thank you for having tribal representation. I've got to hand it to OPI for recognizing that the tribes are a major player in the state. A generation ago, we wouldn't have moved the needle. Two generations ago, we wouldn't have existed as a government. And today, we are an economic engine in this state. Now, right now, what should be happening in this state is we should be the envy of the region, because this is a state that, if it got its act together, if it invested in its people, in education, accepted Medicaid so we can get some of those federal dollars back to cover our people. If we took care of the least among us and helped those in the middle stay there and get ahead, if we did those things, then the partner that this state has in the great Indian nations within its borders that are generating not just millions and millions, but billions in economic activity in this state, our neighbors would be envious. Our neighbors would be envious that you've got a partner in the tribes. But what has happened is I think the state, frankly, has squandered a great opportunity. State Question 712 was a basic partnership between the state and the Indian nations. It's on gaming. It's sharing gaming revenues. What the basic proposition was this. Tribes can engage in casino-style gaming. They'll generate tremendous revenues, hopefully, and they can take care of their people. The state would also get a cut. All right, the state would get a cut. And the basic proposition was the state would take that and invest it in all of the people and help bolster the state budget. But what we've seen, and I think David had a slide up there that showed that the cut that the state got was completely consumed by the tax cut. So the tribes helped pay for a tax cut, and my friends, we didn't sign up to pay for a tax cut. We signed up to join with the state and invest in a way that would be the envy of the region, because the tribes generate millions and millions of dollars and put it back into our people. So we invest in healthcare, we invest in housing, we invest in job training, we invest in our schools. In fact, we sent $4 million to public schools last year, and we've been doing it for years. Public schools with no strings attached. These superintendents are thrilled to get the money because it comes on top of the state money, and they can do whatever they want with it. And Lord knows they need to do something with it because the state's gone the opposite direction. In Cherokee Nation, since 2008, if you look at all of our public schools, there's been a decrease of about 12% in education. So the tribes are going this way. Cherokee Nation is going up with its investment in education, and the state is going down. What if we worked together? What if we both went up? Wouldn't Arkansas, Missouri, and Texas be jealous? Sure they would. And speaking of Texas, you know, Cherokee Nation partnered with the state, and we brought in Macy's. We brought in jobs to this state. That's one example where we got together and generated some economic development, created some jobs. That's one example. What if we kept doing that? What if we kept doing it on education? But it's tough for the tribes to achieve what they need to achieve if the state is eroding the very core parts of government. We ought to be working together. I don't think there's been a time in state history where the state has had a more difficult fiscal crisis and had less ability to do something about it, less will to do something about it. And at the same time, there's never been a time in history in which the tribes have had this much opportunity and have been seizing that opportunity to create jobs and invest in our people. We need to do it together, but the state, frankly, is pulling the rug out from under us. Let's work together.
So I think we've heard a lot about income taxes, and I think the consensus on the panel is that it should be on the table. I hope I'm not misrepresenting anyone. But Senator Jolly, just to talk about some additional or another opportunity to help this particular problem, you mentioned off-the-top appropriations in your opening comments. Can you talk a little bit more about that and what's going to be done this year to try to take some of that money back into the general revenue fund, operating fund?
Well, the problem with off-the-top appropriations is that all of them are going to something that is worthwhile and was done for a purpose. But the reality of it is that while we talk about at the legislature that you cannot bind a future legislature, the reality of it is that we have bound not just future legislatures, but future decades of legislatures through our apportionment process. And I understand why, if I was an agency head, I would absolutely want to have a dedicated revenue stream flowing to my agency. I absolutely understand that. And both parties, Republican and Democrat, have utilized this argument. We want to make sure funding gets to whatever the priority is, because we don't trust the legislature to get the funding there on their own. Well, when you do that in 1965 for the priorities of 1965, and you write into the bill that the apportionments may only grow and they may never decline, and you say that it's the higher of what they got last year or this percentage, it's only going to grow. And we have taken away from legislative ability to adjust spending for the priorities of 2016 because the apportionments that were passed in the 1960s, the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, and in the 2010s and in the 2000s is preventing us from having the funding available to have the discretion to move the money around. This will be the fifth budget that I am able to help write as chairman, sixth overall. Only one of those budgets have I had more money than I did the year before. Every other year, I've had less money to appropriate than the year before. But the total growth of the state budget in each one of those years has grown. Now, a lot of those have resulted in great public policy. We have met the arc on our pension systems for like the first times. I think we've done it twice now. I think this year we're on set. Gary, is it third year? This we'll hit this year, I believe. We'll hit the arc for the third time. That is phenomenal public policy. And we should not want to see that messed with because our pension systems have been woefully underfunded for decades. If we took that away from apportionments, we would have to trust that the state legislature would fund ARCs for the first time since God was a boy. That's just not very likely because that's not been the priority. The same reason we passed the roads bill is that we had left transportation funding at the same level since 1984, and we were desperate to put more money in. Look at the state question on the sales tax increase. What does it do? It apportions the money away from the control of the legislature directly to higher ed, directly to career tech, and directly to common ed. We've got bills all the time that say, hey, would you give money to the cities? Would you give money to the counties? Would you increase our money for this? Would you increase our money for that? Those apportionments take away the flexibility for us to do what we need to do in today's environment. And it is vital that we try to reverse course on those and put the control back in the legislature, but do so in a fashion and in a manner that we do have to fund the ARC. We do have to do the things that are absolutely fundamental priorities that we had neglected prior, that the apportionments have been beneficial. We've got to have that conversation, and it's too late for us to have it now, but it's not too late for us to have it for the future.
Let me ask you this question. How many of you who drove here today think we've spent all the money we need to spend on our roads and bridges in Oklahoma? Anybody by a show of hands say, we're good, don't need to improve, okay? How many of you had kids or grandkids in the public school system think, you know, we spent all the money we need to spend, 35 kids in a classroom is great, we're good. Anybody want to raise your hand? How many of you who are in the teacher retirement system think that 50-something or 60-something percent funded ratio is a good deal? Anybody? No? Okay. How about those of you? How many of you in this room think that we spent all the money we need to spend on helping low-income families get their kids into college that we don't need to spend anymore? Anybody? Of course not. Make no mistake about it. Make no mistake about it. This conversation about off-the-top funding is, and this, it's the same conversation that they're having about, well, we just need to consolidate a bunch of rural schools. It absolutely is a diversion tactic. It takes the eye off the ball. So understand this. The vast majority of that, what they call off-the-top money, funds teacher retirement, state employee retirement, OLAP, transportation funding, House Bill 1017, education funding. That's where the vast majority of the money goes. So understand what the argument is. The argument that they're proffering is this. In order to make up for the cuts in the general revenue budget that we made to higher ed, common ed, transportation, you name it, we're just going to cut higher ed, common ed, transportation, and the off-the-top funding. Does that make sense to anybody else? Right now, if they eliminate the off-the-top funding the way it currently is, next year there will be fewer dollars spent on transportation. Next year there will be fewer dollars spent on higher ed. Next year there will be fewer dollars spent on teacher retirement and public employee retirement spending. Make no mistake about it, because all they're doing is saying, well, we've got this kitty over here, let's just zero it all out and let's just count it on the different balance sheet, on the GR sheet. That's all they want to do. And oh, by the way, when they do that, that money that had been spent on education, healthcare, education, transportation, and retirement, sure, they'll spend a lot of that back on education, healthcare, and retirement, or whatever it is over here, but then they're going to take a portion of it and send it someplace else. to somebody else's pet project, to somebody else that's screaming and hollering and whatnot. That's what they're going to do. So if you get bogged down in the weeds on this off-the-top funding issue, make no mistake about it, you're taking the eye off the ball. The reason we're here is we've got $1 billion worth of taxes. We have tax credits and exemptions that are outsized and continue to grow. And if you want to take money from education to give money to education again, that is not solving the problem.
I'm going to pose one more question to the panel, and then we open up a Q&A. How does the impact represent State Auditor Jones, particularly the impact of taking money from revolving funds? Is that a viable solution, either short-term or long-term? And what has been the impact that you've seen from your office?
Sure. Let me just say this. Since we've taken office, we were 55% funded with appropriations and 45% funded with billed services. We're now down to 35% appropriations and 65% billed services. And the way we've been able to do that, the Tulsa World recently referred to me as a curmudgeonly penny pincher who doesn't have many friends in high places because he tells it the way he sees it. And I, as an auditor, that's the ultimate compliment. And I will tell you this, I was raised as one of seven kids. My dad was a sergeant in the Army, and I told a story last night that one time I went to spend the night with a friend, and he asked his mother what was for supper, and she said, leftovers. I said, what's that? But what we have done is we have had to sit down and determine exactly what we're going to do to make this work. And so we have eliminated, we don't have a chief of staff, we don't have a public relations person, we don't have administrative assistants. We've eliminated all those people and turned them into auditors. That's how we've been able to generate more money. And you know, in December of 2014, our revolving fund got down to $122,000. At an $11 million budget, that's awful close. And so what we said was, let's continue to work to do what we can to eliminate as much cost as possible. We lost a chief financial officer. We did not replace that person. We took on those duties ourselves. We had an accounting person leave. We divided that up. Altogether, we saved $486,000 in salaries. We reviewed our travel policy. We looked at our cars that we have. The auditors have cars. Altogether, we saved almost $600,000. So we built that fund back up to about $700,000 or $800,000. When the appropriation process came through, it said we're taking a cut of 7.25%. We were a little shocked because we thought we would be more like the other people. They were taking a 5 or 6% cut, and we said, okay, we'll figure out how to make it work. But what surprised us was that I got a phone call, and in fact, we saw this $500,000 that was supposedly coming out of our revolving fund. And the call said, from Senator or Representative Sears, said, we're going to take $500,000 out of your revolving fund, and we're going to give it back to you so you can spend it. They didn't take it out. They didn't give it back. What they did is they cut our appropriations the next year by an extra $500,000. So our cut wasn't 7.25, it was 18.5. Now with the other cut, it's 21%. We'll continue to do what we do to cut and get us is down to bare minimums. We haven't given huge raises like some agencies. We've done everything we can to make things work. I was upset about it. I wasn't so much upset about how much they cut. I was upset about the fact that they put out that they gave a 7.25% cut. And I'm going, how do you appropriate money that you don't have? And how do you code that? As an accountant, how do you code that? Well, we saw something later that came out when they talked about the additional cut. So they coded it as permission to spend. I'm going, okay, we have permission to spend money that we generated that we already have the ability to spend. But subsequently, when you do those things, there was 32 different revolving funds and 12 different agencies that they did that to a tune of about $77 million. Our budget doesn't balance. Now, obviously, I understand what they were trying to do. A couple of years ago, they came back and said they're going to take money out of people's revolving funds. The Attorney General said you can't do that. So instead of taking money out of the revolving funds, they just cut an equal amount out of the appropriation process. What really bothers me about this is we go through meetings with the Senate and the House, and we're led to believe the governor's executive budget comes out and she recommends a 4% cut. We're thinking it's going to be somewhere between 4 and 6, maybe 7%. But folks, we have a budget process in Oklahoma that's very similar to the federal government. We've heard people argue and complain about the omnibus budget process. You know, the governor will next week on Monday will come out with her executive budget, and then that gets thrown away and we start the process of the political budget. And then next thing we know, the last week of session, there's a white puff of smoke that comes out and we have a budget. Take it or leave it. And we were surprised because we met with the Senate this week and they said, the question was asked, we want to know why your spending has gone up from 2010 till 2015, 18.9%. And I'm going, I don't think it has. And we went back and looked, and the same senator had told me, he said, the reason I voted to cut your budget because your spending had gone up so much. I go, between 13 and 14, it went up $12,000 on an $11 million budget. And that was some additional money we earned. But what was interesting, we asked for the numbers. What numbers are you looking at for 2015? And they showed that our spending had gone up 5.1% from 2014 to 2015. We asked the question, could you send us those numbers? And we looked at him and said, where did you get these numbers? Well, that's the 2015 budgeted number. In reality, we spent $800,000 less. We reduced our spending, an actual spending of 2.4%. So since 2010, that spending hadn't gone up 18.9. It's gone up 7.8. And if you take off the additional engagements, the additional work that we're doing, it's actually gone down. And so, you know, I'm concerned about the fact that maybe they're not looking at the right numbers. Well, we'd love to have a process that says, when the governor's executive budget comes out, let's start debating from there. Let's have open, substantive discussions, have debate, be able to have people to have input. And so we actually have an idea of what our budget's going to be instead of getting shocked at the last week of session and we have no input in it. So that's.
Okay, we're going to open up a question and answer. Tyler will be walking around here. David Glover, first on bat.
Talking to lots of different people, it seems like there's a growing belief that almost everybody agrees that expanding Medicaid would probably do the biggest thing for the people's lives and economics of Oklahoma. What is going to be the path or trick to actually make that happen? Because it seems like it'd be one of the things that actually could make a difference.
David, I appreciate the question. Our caucus has been staunch supporters of bringing our federal dollars home to take care of our own uninsured for years, and the majority and the governor have refused to do it. Our position since it all became law was simply just expand and bring our dollars home, period. Don't play games with it, just do it. But politics, as Senator Jolly said earlier, trying to get certain things out of this legislature is very difficult. And if you came in even today, even with the numbers, the majority of Oklahomans today support bringing our federal dollars home to take care of our uninsured. They do. Even with those numbers as they are, you still can't get, and with my 30 Democrats in the House, we have 30 now, thanks to Cindy Munson. She just walked in the door a while ago. Even with my 30 Democrats in the House, you got to find 21 more that are willing to just do a straight expansion. I don't know that that happens. So from our perspective, what we've delivered the message to Governor Fallon and others, if you want to use Insure Oklahoma to do it, you want to call it the Oklahoma Plan, you want to call it, you know, the anti-Scott Inman plan, I don't care what you want to call it, just bring our dadgum dollars home and take care of our people. That's our position from this point forward.
Yeah, I know a lot of people are concerned about the strings that are attached to those federal dollars, but my question is, what are the strings attached to the highway funds, the money attached to education, the current Medicare funding we're getting today? There are other states, there are states that are run by conservatives that do this. I think that, like I said, having everything on the table, I think we owe it to the citizens of Oklahoma to go and look and see, is there a plan by which that we can do this and it'll ultimately benefit the citizens of Oklahoma? I think we have to have that on the table.
Anybody else?
I'll just say it's absolutely a political issue. Numerous years ago, we had a vacancy in the Senate because one of our members was elected to be a county officer, and it's actually Representative Emmons, mild stomping ground, Representative Emmons' current stomping grounds. And the state Senate Democrats, their PAC, ran they sent a mail card out against the Republican, saying that the Republican supported Obamacare to try to defeat the Republican. And it was paid for by the Oklahoma State Democratic Senate Majority Fund, or whatever they call it. As long as it has any connotation whatsoever with Obamacare, ACA, federal government, health care or anything, you're going to have a huge problem, and it is a political problem. That's just the reality of it. Now, we've talked about, we've heard people say we should rebrand it. What Representative Emmett was just talking, Scott, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's kind of a rebranding of it. I mean, don't call it Obamacare, call it the Oklahoma option. But there is still a considerable amount of opposition, and the politics of it, both sides recognize that as long as it's called Obamacare, both sides are using it to attack people on both sides of the aisle. And I made a comment that if President Obama came out in favor of motherhood and apple pie, someone would say that, well, mothers aren't that great, and why do we like apples? We should boycott apples. It's just ludicrous, because of his support of it, people just automatically go the opposite, and we can't have a reasoned policy discussion about the pros and the cons. I think we could have that conversation. I still don't know that we would expand at that point.
I really appreciated Mr. Jones's introduction to how the budget actually gets done by first throwing away the governor's budget. I'd really like to know how the sausage is made here in this whole process. And also, we're gonna go talk to our elected officials in Tulsa. What influence or impact could they possibly have on a process like this?
I think the first thing is, the reason the governor's budget is thrown away is because it's fundamentally unfair to the governor. But the governor's budget is built off of completely fictitious numbers that are literally irrelevant 2 to 3 weeks after they present her budget. The real numbers come out 3 weeks after. Now, I have a bill that I filed last year saying, you know what, let's unify those dates, where the governor's budget is no longer a great doorstop that's irrelevant. But the governor built her budget last year off of an assumption of a $300 million shortfall, and then it doubled. It doubled on her 3 weeks after she presented her budget. One of the problems that we have with our state budget, I think, also is that we have not had the interest of the membership in the budgetary process nearly to the extent that the members should be active and engaged. We had a joint meeting of the House and Senate Education Appropriations Subcommittees. There are probably, Scott, how many reps would you say are on that? 2018?
Yeah.
On House Common Ed Appropriations Sub. So
10, maybe.
10, maybe? Okay. So we had 10 there. We got about 8 Senate people. So 18 members. And a few years ago, we had a budget hearing for the Common Ed Subcommittee. We had 3 people show up. And in my mind, that shows a complete lack of interest in the budget and the appropriation process. One of the changes that we've made in the Senate is to put every member on the Appropriations Committee. And another step I took was with the Big 12 agencies. David had a chart earlier that showed that 90% is spent within core government. I'm going to disagree with that chart. It's like 94% is spent within the top 12, or what I call the Big 12 agencies. We brought them in individually for budget hearings during session and had a remarkable attendance by the senators. And I think that shows that there's a shift in mindset. And I'm glad that some of the newer members are taking the process more seriously. I think the other thing that we could do is go to a budget every session and policy every other session. That would, I think, also force more people to be engaged in the budgetary process.
I want to go to the second part of your question, because Senator Jolly really kind of laid out, and Auditor Jones did a nice job of laying out how the budget process has worked. Going back to how you empower those of you in the room and the people that you go to church with and work with and live with and whatnot, if I do anything in my last few years in the legislature, I've got 3 years left. If I do anything, my goal is to talk to groups like yours and everybody else and to try to give you a way to empower you to change the process. And the way you do that is this. A couple of years ago, we had 25,000 teachers at the state capitol, and I gave the biggest speech of my life, and it was a great moment. And a year later, I had 15,000 come, and I gave another big speech, and I had all these educators come to my office afterwards. They weren't all from Dell City. They all came into my office and said, oh, we want to talk to you about your speech and whatever, and we appreciate what you're doing for common education. And I said, great, but where do you live? And they tell me. And I knew exactly who their state representative was. I'd say, did you go talk to your state representative? Absolutely. And I go, what did your state representative say about this education issue? And they said, oh, she's with me. Oh, he's with us. And I looked them straight in the eye and I go, no, they're not. Oh, no, no, but they said they were. And I go, no, they're not. I've lived up here for 9 years. They're not. What vote? Vouchers? You want to talk tax cuts? You want to talk? What do you want to know? They're not with you. Oh, but they said they were. I go, well, what question did you ask them? And I asked them this. They said, will you support public education? There's not a politician in Oklahoma or in the country that says no, right? Right? The way you empower the voters of Oklahoma is this. You must approach the people that represent you with conviction, with confidence, with information, and you must do so with specificity. If you walk up to any politician in Oklahoma and just ask some generic question, will you be with us on education or will you be with us on healthcare? They will always tell you what they want, what you want to hear. We get elected in part because we're good at that, right? Senator Jolly and I are good at that, okay? The way you change this system is you look at them and say, if another tax cut comes up, will you vote yes or no? I need to know right now. If that bill that comes up that's going to fund education or going to take money away from education, will you vote yes or no? And you've got to know the facts. And you've got to ask them specifically. And you've got to make them answer yes or no. No hem-hawing around. And then when they answer the question, you've got to hold them accountable. Because you see, when 25,000 teachers approached the Capitol 2 years ago, it was in March of 2014. They were mad and angry. They came and they said they wanted two things, and some of you have heard me say this before. They wanted two things. They wanted Lee Denny's House Bill 2642 passed, which would have increased off-the-top funding for public education, and they said no more tax cuts. That was March of 2014, of an election year. By May of 2014, when most of those legislators weren't even in the building in March when those teachers came up, by May of 2014, not only was 2642 dead, just the opposite of what they wanted, but not one but two tax cuts were passed. And a few months later, every single one of those individuals who is responsible for violating the wishes of those 25,000 teachers was sent right back to the Capitol to do it again. And until you, the people of Oklahoma, demand with conviction and specificity more accountability out of your public officials, we're going to continue to have what we have.
You've been listening to a panel discussion from the Oklahoma Policy Institute State Budget Summit, recorded on January the 28th in Oklahoma City. The panelists were State Auditor Gary Jones, Republican Senator Clark Jolly, UCO Dean of the College of Business Mickey Heppner, Cherokee Nation Secretary Chuck Hoskin Jr., Democratic Representative Scott Inman, and Norman Mayor Cindy Rosenthal. The moderator was DeMario Solomon Simmons. This discussion was edited for Time. I'm Jacob McClelland. Thank you for listening to Oklahoma Voices.